Hello and welcome to this edition of the Blackwell Podcast. My name is George Miller, and my guest in this programme is the biographer Alexander Masters. Alexander's first book, Stuart, A Life Backwards, told the story of Stuart Shorter, a homeless man whom Masters befriended, and traced that story back to his troubled childhood of abuse. The book won the Guardian First Book Award and was nominated for a host of other prizes and was made into a TV drama by the BBC. That Alexander Masters has an eye for an unusual biographical subject is confirmed by his new book, The Genius in My Basement. As the book jacket laconically puts it, if he found his first subject on a Cambridge pavement, his second was under his floorboards. That subject is Simon Norton, a Cambridge maths genius and former child prodigy, public transport campaigner and inventor of Mackerel Norton, a dish consisting of tinned mackerel and bachelor's Chinese packet rice. Simon sometimes confirms the stereotype of the maths genius, and sometimes completely and gloriously confounds it. What gives the book a great deal of its charm, besides Masters' doodled illustrations throughout, is a relationship that develops between subject and biographer, as Masters struggles to grasp the mathematical complexities that are the everyday furniture of Simon's mental world, and, more importantly, to fathom what it is in a life so different from the norm of job, family and friends that brings Simon happiness and makes Masters feel it is appropriate to subtitle the book The Biography of a Happy Man. When we spoke on the phone, I started by remarking that, on the evidence, Alexander Masters is not at all enticed by the conventional biographer's structure and approach to his subject.
Well, I've got nothing against conventional biography at all, and when I began working on Stuart, my original idea had been, you know, what I'd love to do is, instead of a general, instead of a footballer, instead of a politician, just try and apply that same usual approach to biography to this homeless fellow. And I loved the thought of it, and I felt he deserved such sort of focus. But also I just thought, well, it would be such an intriguing thing to do, because, and then I realized I couldn't do it, or I tried to do it and I failed to do it, because those biographies, they assume the patience of the reader for a long, long time. You know, you'll go through 50 pages of the grandparents and where the ancestry all comes from and the early childhood before the person becomes interesting and so on. I mean, it's only about page 50 that the character is born, usually.
Yeah.
So with Stuart, I couldn't assume that, because people would pick the book up and say, well, why should I read about this guy? I don't know anything about him. I don't know that he has any influence. I don't know that he in any way impinges on my life. So it didn't work to do it the traditional way. And I gave that up, really realizing at the same time that at the same time I sort of increasingly coming to the conviction that basically writing is just, it's an entertaining job. I mean, it's a job in entertainment. And, you know, writers tend to get quite precious about their role in society and so on, but basically they're just a form of entertainer. And then I thought, well, in that case, biographies, if I'm going to write about someone like Stuart and get someone intrigued by this person, I can't assume that I have the reader's attention at all. I have to fight for it right from the beginning. So I have to start telling stories. It has to start in the middle. It has to start like a piece of journalism, really. It has to start straight away with some excitement or some sense that you're in the midst of the story to build up the reader's interest. So I ended up coming away from those, you know, proper biographies, not because I disdained them, but just because I realized it wouldn't work in this case.
To put it more positively, you've discovered lots of other ways of exploring how lives develop, the course they take, the dead ends or the surprises, and you use visuals, you make yourself a character in the book, so you've got a whole panoply of other ways of telling the story.
Well, this to me, I said it in a sort of the wrong tone. I mean, to me, the sort of realization that basically I was an entertainer, that's what my job was, to be an entertainer, was incredibly releasing. It just allowed me to think about each page in turn. Did this keep me entertained? Did this make me want to read about Stuart? Did this give Stuart some depth that intrigued me? And sort of, I ended up pacing the whole book really in terms of this, page by page. And if quite often I'd write a page over and over again, and when drawings came in Stuart, and there are a great many more in Simon, in this last book, when the drawings came in, they came in because I couldn't get the mood right with writing. And I was just sort of thinking, I doodled a bit already. But then I thought, it was the only thing, if I imagined a drawing being there, it was the only thing that seemed to give it that extra little bit of structure that would stop it from having a feel of inevitability or obvious pacing. I just gave it a little jolt. So they came in sort of without planning. They came in because I couldn't write in a way that would do the same trick as the drawing. So that sort of led to all these little devices. I mean, they're not schemed or plotted. Mm. You get to the point you think, hang on, this isn't working. I can't think how to write this. You know, a different writer would be able to do it, but I can't do it. I've got to do something else. I've got to go into a different format.
So on one hand, you've got the reader who's waiting to be entertained, and on the other, you've got a subject who's a real human being whose life is in some way linked to your own. Does that raise ethical issues? Are some, you know, is there a balance to be struck there between the entertainment and trying to do justice to the human subject?
I'd say by entertainment, I don't mean just, you know, let's have a giggle at this character, or, you know, it's all a great romp and good fun. I don't mean that. I mean it very loosely in terms of keep the person's attention, keep the reader's attention alive. And in that sense, no, I don't think it has any, and it raises any issues. Because if, for example, we say with this last book, which I did a lot with a lot of cooperation, I mean, the theme of the book is the battle between me and Simon. I don't think it raises any difficulties because you just have to find out ways of devising the text so that it is agreeable to everyone. It's agreeable to Simon. It's, you know, I feel that I'm explaining a character without sort of seeming to dismiss him or underrate him or make fun of him or in some way lessen him, which is the constant difficulty in biography, that you oversimplify the character, that you start to paint them too much in your own image. And this has been, you know, it's been actually this avoidance of formality, this concentration on keeping the reader's attention, trying to keep them interested in what's going on, rather than assuming that interest will be there, has been quite easy to manage in one sense against the subject, making sure that the subject doesn't get badly portrayed or doesn't get mistreated in some way.
I mean, Alexander, tell me then how the idea for writing about Simon Norton came to you. Did it creep up on you very gradually?
Well, yeah, I mean, when I first met him in the mid-90s, I had no intention of writing about him then. I had really very little sense of who he was or what he'd done. I had some feeling that I'd heard some little thing that he was a mathematician. But when I was writing Stuart, and I was living in Simon's house at that time, you know, I came to the end of Stuart, and I realized, you know, and the book did all right, and then I thought, I want to do another one, you know, clearly I can, and the publishers were saying, can you do another one? And well, I didn't want to go pursuing homeless people around the place. I had a homeless friend and a friend who had been homeless for a large portion of his life, and I wrote the biography about him. So what I needed to do was look around other people I knew, other people with whom I had gradually built up a relationship and a friendship not based just on, oh, look, can I get a biography out of you? But just it had turned out inevitably to be some sort of quite close connection between the two of us, and find the interesting ones and think, well, could I do a biography of them? And Simon was a very obvious case. He tied in some senses with Stuart, because just as Stuart was a stereotypical homeless person, you know, he had fucked a tooth down his arm and a broken nose, he often had a black eye, and, you know, and he was often found on the streets, and he drank a lot, and he took drugs. And yet, you didn't have to go very far to realize there was something much, much deeper and much more interesting and much more complex going on with this man than this sort of black and white figure. Simon was sort of the same, because take one look at him and you think, oh, mad mathematician. I mean, he looks at his hair, looks exactly right. He's got blobs on his T-shirts. He sort of shuffles about. He's not brilliant at chit-chat. In fact, he's rotten at chit-chat. But because by that time I knew him, you only had to spend a few minutes with him before you realized, hang on, there's something a lot more to this. And I was very intrigued by this. I think I am generally quite intrigued by people who seem to fit into one bracket, very clearly into one bracket, and you're almost about to dismiss them as that. And you just think, well, no, hang on, I'll pause, and I'll just ask one more question. And often with that one more question, you find this person has a whole aspect, a whole depth, a whole quality that is not just intriguing about them, but often seems to tell you something about yourself, because you realize, oh, this is how I behave, or humans behave, ordinary humans behave in sort of strange circumstances. In Stuart's case, in finding yourself without a home and full of addictions. In Simon's case, finding yourself possessed of a great but very narrow genius.
You write about the task of being Simon's biographer as like trying to write the biography of a hedge. And I wondered,
yes,
if you could, I wondered if you could say in what ways he is resistant to the conventions of biography.
Well, it's, it, as he pointed out, he thought some botanists would be very pleased with that idea of the book and might be out buying it now. He has very little interest in what is going on in his life. I mean, he has, you know, this astonishing analytic capacity in terms of mathematics and an astonishing willingness to think about environmental issues. He's not quite so brilliant at that, and campaigning about it. He thinks about that all the time. I don't think he has a great genius at it, as he does at the mathematics, but he has no interest or desire really to look at himself, to study himself, to think about himself, to reflect on why he does things. I mean, it's almost impossible to get him to remember large portions of his life, and then the bits he does remember turn out to be utterly at odds with the sort of thing that you would feel important. So the period at which his genius is developing, or the period which his genius appears to be, and it's only appears to be, because I still think he possesses it, it's just become a little less concentrated on, the period where it appears to be fading away, it doesn't interest him at all. What he does remember is, for example, that once in Trinity College, he was trying to get to sleep, and there was a water pump going on outside his window, went on all night, and stopped at 12, and that's it. That's what he remembers from this triumphant period at Trinity. And it makes it sort of very, to begin with, you just sit there sagging, saying, what am I going to do with this? And then you realize that actually there's a sort of story in that about you and someone else struggling to investigate the person's life when they are so much less interested in their life than you are. And that's a very odd position to find yourself in. So because of the difficulty of writing about Simon, because of his lack of engagement with anything that a biographer wants a subject to engage with, it sort of pushed the book in a certain way and became almost dictated how the book would have to be written, because unless you played with that, unless you used that, unless you took the comedy of that, but also the poignancy of that and made it central, the book was just going to be impossible. There was no way. I mean, you'd have 4 pages of book.
Well, I mean, I think one of the great joys of the book for me was the little interjections which you allow Simon to have, because you're showing him drafts of the chapters you're writing and he's coming back with comments, and they're a sort of wonderful counterpoint running through the main narrative.
I think partly, as I say, partly because just it, you know, my struggle to try and get Simon interested in this book and trying to get Simon to remember things ended up being so comic sometimes that it was clearly had to be an important part of the story. But I think there's another thing as well, which is particularly if you're writing about people who aren't famous and people who will have no right of reply, in the sense that you can work with them, but once the book is out, there's no way Simon's going to write a biography about himself. I mean, it's just not the sort of thing he's going to do. So you have a real, you're sort of honor bound to make sure that the person gets as fair a hearing as possible, and you don't end up just, you know, the last thing you want to do is end up trashing this person. But inevitably, at the same time, the person is going to feel your representation of them is not quite what they want, because no one's happy with the way other people think about them.
I mean, I imagine one of the other challenges, Alexander, was in how on earth to write about the very sophisticated mathematics that Simon has spent his career pondering, and how did you tackle that?
Well, now you see, I thought about this quite a lot, because I did some mathematics myself. I you know, as a graduate and so on. Not to a very high level, but I got a degree in it, or mathematical physics stuff. And I thought about group theory, which is Simon's specialist subject. It's a very interesting subject because it can get amongst mathematicians, it's regarded as very, very pure. It's very beautiful. It's something the most ascetic mathematicians like to involve themselves in, and regarded as incredibly difficult, you know, once you get up to a high level. But part of what appeals to the mathematicians about it, part of where this sense of its beauty comes from, is that its origins are extremely simple. And it simply has to do with symmetries, the way a square looks the same if you rotate it 4 times, or a triangle 3 times. It's really elementary stuff, the sort of thing you cut out of Day-Glo paper when you were at junior school, kindergarten, and played around with, and sort of It's this really very, very basic subject, but somehow out of that, this astonishing mathematical language appears. So I thought to myself, well, there's no point me trying to begin to understand Simon's end of it. I mean, I can try and get a rough idea of what's going on. But there's no point in, you know, me trying to come to grips with it, certainly not in a popular book. But what I can do, which I thought was interesting, would be to try and show how it goes from something that seems so elementary that it's facile, that it seems entirely reserved for 4- and 5-year-olds, how that can turn into a subject that might absorb someone of Simon's stature, how the mathematics comes out of something very, very basic. That seemed to me an interesting thing you could do. And so I never get into discussion of Simon's specialist subject in any technical sense, which is a very complex type of group theory. All very, very elementary, and the point is if you follow through the drawings and the doodles and the little anecdotes and stories, the point is just to reach a position where you realize, this is how a subject that seems so utterly, idiotically, stupidly simple can become a subject, maths can breed in it and turn it into a subject that is just absurdly complicated and extraordinary and magical to the point where Simon calls it the voice of God. I love the sense of the voice of God coming out of something so tiny, something so small, something so seemingly irrelevant.
And that tingle, I think you described the tingle of beautiful maths. I think I got a glimpse of what that might be like for the first time in reading the book, and you compare it to sort of the highest level of artistic achievement, and also on a trip to the Norwegian fjords, Simon compares it to the beauty of nature, and I think that I got at least a little glimpse of what it might be like to experience that.
It's a very interesting thing, because mathematicians will often talk about beauty in mathematics. And everyone nods and agrees and says, yes, math is very beautiful and it's all about beauty and we're all guided by beauty. But actually, if you ask any mathematicians, what do they mean by that? They clam up pretty quick. They can't really tell you. I mean, there are loads of mathematicians who have written about it, and they're all pretty unsatisfactory descriptions of what beauty is in mathematics. It seems to be something to do with economy. It seems to be, very importantly, connecting disparate areas of mathematics with a sort of quickness and grace and unexpectedness. These are very critical parts of it. But most of the time, the mathematician will say something like, oh, well, you know, it's beautiful in the same way that Beethoven is beautiful. And you think, what's that mean? So I spent ages talking with Simon, because Simon has none of those sort of silly affectations about comparing it with Beethoven or something. You can nag at him and get a very straightforward response back. He's not going to try and sort of say another favorite thing of mathematicians to say, for example, is, well, if you don't feel it, I can't tell you. And you think, well, again, that doesn't tell me, it doesn't lead me anywhere. So Simon, I had a lovely long discussion with him, and it was in this that his very straightforwardness and his lack of romantic imagery and his need to be precise about things, but total disinterest in adopting a pose, was incredibly useful and insightful for me to understand just what he meant, because at the same time he was sort of saying, look, here I am, this mathematician, I believe the fundamental tenet of all mathematics is that there is an internal consistency. As long as you get your symbols up there, as long as they work within each other, that's fine. What we mustn't have is any sort of illogical steps or lead to sort of contradictions, but that's the guiding principle once you've set up the basics. Whereas on the other hand, Simon's saying, but I'm guided by beauty, or mathematicians, I'm guided by beauty, which is the most subjective thing. So how can they have this sort of internal consistency and then this weird, highly inconsistent idea of beauty? And Simon's just very, very good at sort of bringing those two notions together through this very simple sense of there being this sort of mathematical tingle, which he described by comparing it to a certain mountain as we are passing, because he got so exasperated with my hammering away at him. He just said the only way to describe it is it's the same tingle I feel when I look at that mountain. And that seemed to me, it doesn't sort of suddenly answer what mathematical beauty is, but it gives you a feel of why it's forceful. And I'd never understood that before.
I also hadn't understood the extent to which it is collaborative. Do you think this goes some way to explaining the myth which surrounds Simon, that he said, in fact, it's not so much that as the circumstances in which he did his best work changed and he was no longer able to continue as part of that team?
I think you're absolutely right. I don't think he did suffer a devastating intellectual collapse. I think that's what other mathematicians say about him. you know, they were getting better. He was not progressing much. He'd got to his astonishing position very, very early when he was in his teens, whereas most of the others took him to their 30s to reach that sort of capacity and have the equipment, the mental equipment to do it. And so they mistook, as I say, they mistook their arrival for his departure. But I do think what happens in his 30s, you know, his community of mathematicians faded away. The things you meet with so many mathematicians, that's how they work. They work by debate. They work by throwing ideas back and forth. One gets it wrong, the other corrects it, the other turns out to have got it also slightly wrong, the third comes in and makes an adjustment. But this is constant. If you listen to mathematicians, or indeed all scientists, they get together and they thrash ideas out. And it's wonderful to watch. I mean, it's very hard to follow what they're doing, but they'll take any silly notion and they'll build up on it and they'll throw it back and forth and and one will say a stupid thing, the other will pick it up, but then the stupid one who said the stupid thing will suddenly twist it slightly, realizing where he's got wrong, and come through with something marvelous. So it's a very, very energetic community spirit that goes on amongst most mathematicians. I mean, there are the isolated geniuses who go off and sit around moping in their parents' attic and so on. But they tend to be fairly rare and not necessarily better because of it.
Let me ask you in conclusion, Alexander, you subtitle your biography, The Biography of a Happy Man. What do you think the nature of Simon's happiness is? And is it a qualified happiness, would you say?
Well, it's not that he is constantly jumping about and leaping for joy. But to me, he has all the ingredients necessary for happiness. And most people who meet him will say, there's clearly a happy man. Now, I think disappointment can be part of the life of a happy person, but he has mental contentment in the sense he is constantly occupied either with mathematics or with his environmental campaigning. He has a sense of social purpose. These are profoundly important, to my mind, for happiness. He's not lonely. He's got no financial worries. And he has he's got a few minor health troubles, but they're not great. There's no point at which he feels his life is empty. And that seems to me such a fundamental ingredient of happiness that he, you know, within the day-to-day, he gets very annoyed, he gets very upset about the way the government is cutting buses and so on. And this grieves him. I mean, it really does grieve him. But I don't think that makes him not a happy man or not a man who has fundamentally got all the parts necessary for happiness. And so it's not happiness in a sort of a clownish sense, but it's happiness in a sense of a life well lived. And I think he's got that. And to me, that ranks as one of his great triumphs, because amongst other mathematicians, he's regarded as this catastrophic collapse figure. And not amongst all mathematicians, there are several who still believe he's got everything it takes. But amongst many mathematicians, he's an archetype of what they fear. And yet Simon, it doesn't bother him in the slightest. He isn't perturbed. He still does the maths when he wants to. He campaigns on behalf of the world for the rest of the time. And he feels that it is a life full of direction and function and value. And that just seems, for someone who has apparently lost something that's so golden, that he comes out of it without any sense of loss, is fundamentally a quality of a happy man.
Alexander Masters. The Genius in My Basement is available now in hardback. You'll find it, plus several million other titles, at blackwell.co.uk. On the Blackwell site, you'll also find a podcast archive with over 150 author interviews by clicking on the podcast tab on the home page. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for another programme. And until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.